Thank you for the reminder. Okay, so this is apologetics session number 12, and we're talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So at the front of your outline there at the top, it says overall outline at the top. Oh, and by the way, the little numbers and letters at the top of the header, it says AV6. That, again, corresponds to the branches outline that I gave you at the beginning of the class. It's the organization. So those things make sense if you look at the branches and see the flow of the material. Okay. yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
What color tab is it supposed to be?
Oh, it'll be in the last tab. So the pink one, I believe, is the last one.
Orange.
Orange is pink to me. It's, everything's relative, you know. Orange is orange to you, pink. Orange is orange to me, so just kidding. That was a postmodernist bash. Sorry, Tiff. If Tiff didn't laugh, then it's terrible. Okay, so the overall outline here I'm giving you, and you could use this, the charges against the evidence for Jesus' resurrection are inaccurate, or you could say faulty. They're bad. They're not good. Okay, so the charges against the evidence that we use to show the resurrection of Jesus have issues. They have errors. They're faulty. They're inaccurate. Okay, the alternative theories explaining away Jesus' resurrection have challenges that cannot be overcome. So when people present an alternative view on what the resurrection meant or could be, when we talk about the resurrection, those alternative theories have challenges that cannot be overcome. They have problems. They can't get past these challenges, and therefore we reject that alternative theory. And finally, the evidence provides a compelling case for a historical resurrection event, that the resurrection actually occurred in history. So it's a historical event. So this theory, that the resurrection happened, is the theory with the most explanatory power and scope. So it does the most work out of all the theories, and it makes sense, and we have a lot of good evidence for it. So we can be justified and rational in holding that theory, whereas the alternative theories that is mentioned in part two have errors and issues that cannot be overcome. So the first part of this outline is what we're going to get into tonight. We're going to probably get to, I believe we're going to get to like 18, page 18 or so tonight. and you'll see a couple pages we'll actually skip, and we won't talk about, because the material, it's not, I'll tell you when we get there. I may just summarize it for you. So why is this topic important? Among those who rarely or never attend church, 46% believe Jesus rose from the dead. Meaning 54% of people who don't go to church do not believe Jesus resurrected. That's a lot of people. They don't think he resurrected. So this is a big deal. Recently, popular and scholarly criticisms have erupted in books, radio, and online. And below, I have here a list of things people say, a bunch of statements people make. And the star, when you see an asterisk, it indicates that it's also an ancient criticism that was around during the time of the early church, who actually had their own apologists, theologians, and philosophers. And they responded to those things during that time. So here's a bunch of criticisms we hear. Don't you get it? And this first one's a little graphic, I apologize. Don't you get it? Crucified people were left to hang there on the cross until the birds pecked away most of their face. The corpse would have been thrown into a mass grave only to be consumed by wild dogs. They weren't buried in tombs. Joseph of Arimathea is made up. So this charge against our evidence that we say he was in a tomb and now the tomb is empty, this charge is saying that no, Jesus was left on the cross, birds probably pecked away at his face, and he was probably thrown into a mass grave just like all the other crucified victims in the Roman era. And they weren't buried in tombs, and this Joseph guy comes out of nowhere. You Christians made him up. Another charge, there are contradictions and inconsistencies in the empty tomb accounts, and they cannot be trusted. There were different women, guards versus no guards, rock versus no rock, one angel versus no angel versus two angels. He rose before sunrise or after sunrise. Which was it, Christian? Figure it out. Your account is unreliable. Another charge. So maybe the tomb was empty. So what? No one actually saw him rise. So this is saying that no one witnessed the resurrection. It's a good charge, right? What are we going to say to that? Another charge. Honestly, anybody can break into a tomb and steal a body. We do it all the time. Okay, so no one actually told me that. I just wrote that in. And this one, the disciples stole the body while the guards were sleeping. Another charge. Because Mark's gospel cuts off, leaving the reader with questions, the disciples later reported that Jesus rose from the grave. They just added information in other later biographies that Mark's earlier gospel didn't have, because Mark's gospel cuts off, leaving the reader with questions. Another charge, the resurrection was made up to continue the story of their dead mentor. Another one, Jesus' resurrection was only spiritual in nature and not physical. The body remained dead. Okay, so meaning that he was basically a ghost when he appeared to them. They were hallucinating, referring to the disciples. Just like when we are smoking weed. We have visions of dead folks all the time, especially when we're on drugs. All right? Who can attest to that? I don't know. Don't raise your hand. They conjured up these dreams in the midst of their emotional despair, like many do when loved ones pass. So you're kind of missing a loved one, and you may have a dream of that loved one. That's what happened to them. And last one here, they were so emotionally involved with the expectation of the risen Messiah that their minds projected hallucinations of Jesus. Okay, so they're emotionally charged, and they just want Jesus to be back so much that they project this hallucination of him. Okay, so these are some of the charges that we're actually going to face tonight and get into next week as well. And we're going to develop responses for them, and we're going to use them on each other, and then use them on the street, if possible. Without the resurrection of Jesus, the following is true. Jesus is not God, because he lied and when he said he would come back and be risen, and he didn't. Jesus is not the Messiah. He didn't fulfill messianic prophecies and bring future kingdom power to the world, and his Holy Spirit really never came if he never rose again. We are still dead in our sins, and there's no way to God or heaven if Jesus didn't rise from the grave. And our faith is in vain. It's a waste of time, energy, money, etc. And Christianity is based on a lie and not facts of history. And the doctrines of Christianity ought to be rejected. And in fact, no one ought to be a Christian. Now, if Jesus didn't rise from the grave, all of these things would be true. All of them. Christianity would be totally invalid, and everything that you've ever learned would be flawed. It would be based on a lie. It would be based on a historical event that actually never took place. It'd be non-historical. So this is a very weighty, weighty topic, and it happens to be the most powerful topic in the entire Bible, because not only is it interesting that a guy was brought back to life after being killed, and that's intriguing alone, but it happens to be the source of our Christian hope and faith for our future. So when we die, we'll have a resurrected body like his, the Bible talks about. And if that's not true, then all the pain and suffering we face in this world has no real purpose to it after this world. It's just irrational, and there's no meaning to our pain and suffering. Revelation says in the future kingdom in heaven, there will be no more tears, no more pain, no more sorrow. And all of that would not be true. So we live and die, we're annihilated, our soul ceases to exist. and everything you face in this life is meaningless. So there's a whole lot at stake with the resurrection of Jesus, and it has to be true, or else we're all to be pitied most of all humanity, the Christians are. Okay, so Christianity lives or dies on the hill of the resurrection, and we're going to get right into it. Next page. The charges against the evidences for Jesus' resurrection are inaccurate. They're faulty. They're flawed. They have problems. They're not true. Charge number one, don't you get it? Crucified people were left there to hang on the cross till the birds pecked away most of their face. The corpse would have been thrown into a mass grave only to be consumed by wild dogs. They weren't buried in tombs, and Joseph of Arimathea, he's made up essentially, and I'm saying here, he would not have ruled on his death and then taken the body. That means that he was part of the Bible writers basically say that Joseph of Arimathea was part of the council that ruled that Jesus should be punished and crucified. And so the critique here, the criticism is saying that there wouldn't have been a person that would rule on his death and then go take his body and put it in a nice grave. So that whole idea is made up, is what the criticism is. Because it doesn't make sense for a leader to go do that, especially one who's said that he should be crucified. Okay, so how do we respond to that? It's true. Common burial graves were typical for most crucified criminals, but not for all criminals. Most of the time in the ancient Near East, in the Roman era, when you had a criminal dying, you would throw them their bodies in a mass grave. They don't deserve a proper burial. But not all the time. That didn't happen all the time. Some were given a dignified burial. And in this case, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a rich member of the Sanhedrin, the ruling council, who did not consent to the action against Christ, the Bible teaches that he actually was either not there or he did not agree with the vote to crucify Jesus. He took the body and laid him in a tomb that he owned nearby. Now, we have no other accounts of Jesus' burial. We have no alternative documents, or we don't have any historical documents presenting an alternative case that Jesus' body was taken and chopped up into a million pieces, and then they were eaten by a cannibal tribe nearby. We don't have any story like that. We don't have a story that Jesus' body was thrown into a mass grave or burned. We don't have any alternative explanation. This is the only one we got. It's highly improbable that the early Christians would have invented a member of the ruling council to give Jesus a proper burial when all of the disciples deserted him. They should have followed through with the burial because they were his followers. They should have took care of him. But instead, they credited another, especially one who was on the enemy council. So they gave the credit to this guy, the same guy that was at the at the vote. And maybe they didn't know at the time that he voted, I don't know, or voted against it. But he was still part of that enemy council, if you will. Why didn't they give the credit to themselves? Why didn't they say, we took Jesus' body off the cross and we put him in a site in Galilee. We buried him in Galilee in Nazareth, where he's from. They didn't do that. They didn't take the credit for themselves like they should have. They should have, you know, put in writing that they did the right thing. But they wanted to tell the truth, so they didn't do that. They said it as it actually happened. This is the account. We're not making this up. Joseph of Arimathea is mentioned in all four Gospels, which is very interesting because all four Gospels don't have certain things like this. They have certain things mentioned maybe two Gospels or three Gospels, but this is very important. It's mentioned in all four. And the Sanhedrin could have denied his existence, but they didn't. So this implies that Joseph of Arimathea was real. The ruling council didn't write down somewhere that, oh no, Joseph of Arimathea wasn't real. We don't know who that guy is. We don't have any report like that. They could have easily provided that information, but they didn't. And people who read the Gospels could have looked up Joseph for themselves to question him, So in the year, say, AD 55 or AD 60, when the Gospels were being written and circulated, they could have said, okay, who's this Joseph of Arimathea guy? Let's go find him and talk to him. And we don't have any report of people going to talk to him and Joseph saying, no, I never did that. I don't even know who this Jesus guy was. In fact, I voted for him to be crucified. We don't have an alternative report of Joseph denying burying Jesus. So for all we know, it hasn't been denied. Now, I'm not creating an argument from silence. I'm not doing that here. I'm just saying that it adds to the information that Joseph, we don't have a report of Joseph denying this and the Sanhedrin denying Joseph's existence. In fact, what we have is a report that the Pharisees themselves went to the tomb to seal it with guards ordered by Pilate to protect the tomb. So even the ruling council who sentenced Jesus were intimately aware of the tomb Joseph placed him in. So the charge against the view that he was put in a tomb, like we hold, that he was buried in a mass grave, the ruling council, the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, they don't agree with that. They actually went to the tomb and put a seal on the tomb so that the disciples would later not be able to steal the body, and posted guards there with Pilate's permission. So the charge against the view that Jesus was buried in a mass grave, or the charge against our view that Jesus was buried in a tomb, that and they say he was buried in a mass grave, that charge is totally inaccurate. It's totally faulty, because the evidence is right there. If someone just reads the Gospels, they'll see that the Pharisees, the people that actually sentenced him to death, know exactly where the tomb is. They went there to put a seal on it. So we have evidence from an enemy that says he was actually buried in that tomb. Now, this is extremely important, because once Jesus is in the tomb, there's two options. Either his body is still there to this day, or it's not. But we know for sure it was in a tomb. Okay, so keep that in mind as we go through this. Charge number two. Any questions so far? Tracking? Charge number two. There are contradictions and inconsistencies in the empty tomb accounts, and they can't be trusted. Different women, guards, rock, no angel, angel, no angel. We've talked about this a couple weeks ago when we looked at the specific Bible difficulties and alleged contradictions. We even brought up this very scenario right here as an example. Now, I'm not going to repeat all that information on how to understand specific Bible difficulties and alleged contradictions, but I want you to just tune in with me real quick on this. Even if there were contradictory features, let's say there are, let's say the Bible and the Gospels are completely unreliable and they suck and they're terrible, it still has this core story. Joseph of Arimathea takes the body and puts it in the tomb. We know that for sure, even if other things are contradictory. That's not. The tomb is visited by a small group of women followers early Sunday morning following the crucifixion. Even if there's contradictories, that's still in the story. It's still part of the same story. And three, they find that the tomb is empty, with visions of angels saying that Jesus is risen. So even if there's a rock or no rock, or how many angels or guards or no guards, doesn't matter, because these core points, I don't have a PowerPoint for you this week, sorry. I wanted to show off something else. But these core points are still there. So what appears to be contradictions is actually complementary evidence. At the end of the day, all of the alleged contradictions can either be harmonized or accounted for with appropriate hermeneutics. If the stories were all the same, it would be harder for us to believe, as they could have gotten together and decided what the appropriate public relations report would need to be. Okay, so we've talked about this a little bit before, so I don't want to get into it in too much detail, but it's interesting that Mark, let's just take a step back here. Scholars tend to think that Mark got his information from Peter. And Peter may have given this information perhaps even in another document that we don't have, known as Q. Scholars call it Q, just because they want to put it some name on it. And we don't have the information, so they think that Q existed, and Luke and Matthew and Mark all read Q while they were developing their story and talked with others to finish the biography they were writing. So Mark's account seems like it was from Q and Peter, okay? And it's the earliest of the Gospels. So what we see in Mark is a simple story. It's a very primitive sort of reaction, if you will. Even though it was 20 years later, it's still kind of a reaction. It's very raw, okay? And the writing in Mark is very raw, too. It's not polished. It's not very theological or heady. So there's no legendary developments in Mark. The woman discovering the tomb was an embarrassment for the authors to admit, as women were of a lower status than men. Outside of the gospel accounts, we still have an empty tomb, which I talk about below. And so here's a quote from a historian. The discovery of the empty tomb is differently described by the various Gospels, but if we apply the same sort of criteria that we would apply to any other ancient literary sources, the evidence is firm and plausible enough to necessitate the conclusion that the tomb was indeed found empty. Okay, so he's just saying there that when you look at Mark itself as a literary document, we can see that there's certain criteria that Mark gives us and meets that give a good presentation and a good case, creates a good case just in and of itself that he was telling the truth. It's so raw, it's got embarrassing accounts and other features like we've talked about in other classes. So it's believable and reliable. The empty tomb then forms a veritable rock on which all rationalistic theories of the resurrection dash themselves in vain. This is from another historian. So the resurrection is well attested to, or sorry, the empty tomb is well attested to by many scholars, many historians, and even non-Christian ones like these guys. They agree that there was an empty tomb. So Jesus' body is in the tomb, and now we have people that are not Christians, scholars, looking back, looking at all the evidence and the data and saying, yes, I agree, the tomb was empty. How many scholars, there's a philosopher, theologian, historian guy named Gary Habermas. Has anybody heard of him? Okay. He has done 25 to 30 plus years of research on the resurrection alone with grad students of his. He's a PhD in somewhere in Atlanta area. And he's written great books on this. You're not going to find much better material on the resurrection than Gary Habermas and William Lane Craig and N.T. Wright. And I brought one of N.T. Wright's books here. This is about 800 pages just on the resurrection, okay? And he is a top-notch scholar. Him, Habermas, and William Lane Craig are probably some of the world's best experts on the resurrection from a historical point of view. Habermas, in the past 25 years or so, 30-something years, he has done research, and he's told his grad students to help him, and they research things for him, and over the last 30 years, they found 2,000 scholars or so agree with this point. And it turns out that it's more than 75% of them agree with the empty tomb. Christian or not, doesn't matter. They all concede to this point, that the tomb was indeed found empty. This is very, very important. This is extremely interesting, because if all these secular scholars said, no, the tomb wasn't empty, his body is still there, and the Christian scholars say, yes, it was, then that doesn't help us much. But we have secular scholars who are not Christians saying, yes, the tomb was empty. We know this by a lot of evidence. Okay? And we're going to get into more information on the empty tomb and how to know that how to agree on that fact ourselves. We haven't looked at much evidence for it, but I'm just giving you a heads up here that more than 75% of scholars, over 2,000 of them, believe that the tomb was empty. Okay, and there's an interview here, and I think we're going to watch this after the break. Probably not this one, but another one. Charge number three. So maybe the tomb was empty. So what? No one actually saw him rise. Now, before you read anything, I want to just give some feedback from you. What would you say to this? What would you say to this? Yeah. Actually, in the Bible, that says it. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15,
yeah.
The 500.
There was like, yeah, that have seen it and that wrote about it. Wasn't there people that didn't even...
Were skeptics.
Like,
yeah.
That wrote that they had seen the risen Christ?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good point. So, but you're talking about something after the fact. They saw the risen Jesus, but they didn't see him actually get up from the grave. Like, actually come out of the grave clothes. You know, they didn't see the burst of light or the stars around him. Okay. That's a good point. That's a good question.
Are they saying he didn't die? That's what they're saying?
No, they're saying no one actually saw him rise, so we don't know that he actually did. And all the reports of him being risen can be explained away in other ways. But no eyewitness saw him get up from the tomb, saw him get up from the lying down position. Okay, so you would ask the question, is it necessary for someone to see him for that to happen? It's a good question. So I'm saying true, the New Testament doesn't describe the actual act of rising, but it is not necessary for someone to see it for it to be true or false. The actual act of rising doesn't require an eyewitness for it to happen, obviously. We don't have to be there for the magic trick to take place, right? The magician could do a magic trick in his garage if he wanted. The New Testament does describe the conditions causing the disciples' belief. It describes, like you said, the risen the appearance encounters, and it describes an empty tomb. So I would just leave it at that. And you don't have to go much further here, because the person is basically saying that, look, I need an eyewitness to tell me that he saw Jesus get up from the grave. But in reality, we have much better evidence than that. We have him appearing to 500, like you said, appearing to skeptics and others. So this goes away rather quickly when you're talking to somebody. As long as you use good tactics like you did, you presented a question. That was good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we're going to see that they're going to start doubting the other accounts. Now, charge number four and five are kind of interesting. They're not used often, but I found these charges. I want to give them to you. We're not going to spend a lot of time on them. The disciples preached and died for fame, power, and position in an emerging institution. They could have confessed about their fictitious resurrection story if they wanted to, but they had ulterior motives, so they chose to hold on to it. They wanted power during their life, and they knew that if they died for it, they would go down in history as famous heroes and co-founders of a huge religion. So some scholars actually charge this. They say that the disciples knew the aftermath of the resurrection. If they held on to this fictitious story they made up till death, they knew what would take place. They knew Christianity would spread, and all of Western civilization would be influenced by it. So how do we respond to that? You know, they say they had an ulterior motive, selfishness. This is a little bit of an elaboration there on the next page, but basically the response is, in item two, an appeal to status and fame for the martyrs seems ad hoc and conjured up, meaning that it's made to fit what they present the evidence in a way that makes it fit for their theory. Fame and power are useless upon death, and dying for a lie is foolishness and absurd. Then she goes on, you know, I'm kind of critiquing her here. This is the person, Lucy Grigg, who's an English scholar of ancient history and literature in the Christian era. She goes on, earlier in her article, she says that Ulpian, a Roman law expert, says that by quaestro, which means basically questioning with torture, as the Romans did when they were persecuting the Christians, by quaestro we mean the infliction of bodily torment and pain for the drawing out of the truth. She's saying that the act of quaestro, the questioning with torture, performed by the Romans seems then to be for the revealing of truth, like that of interrogating a spy or a criminal in court. It's just with controlled pain. So she's actually contradicting herself by citing Ulpian, who is a Roman law expert of the time, who was actually there, and he's saying something that goes against her own claim that the object of the questioning, the torture, is to force the accused to obliterate, basically lie away his crime. So what she's basically saying here is that the Romans were torturing them for the purpose of them spilling the beans and getting some confession, okay? The purpose of the torture was to get a confession, and those who were being tortured knew that all they had to do was confess, and the torture would stop, and they would just be killed. So she's saying that they just said some sort of confession so the torture would stop, and they would be killed, and they'd go down in history as a hero. But what this Roman historian, Ulpian, is saying is that no, that's not what happened. They actually questioned for truth, like we would do when we're interrogating a spy or a terrorist. And she brings this up in her very own article. So it's contradictory. She's presenting something about history that's contradicting a Roman historian at the time. And so this is obviously just a contradiction in her own writing, and so we reject it. Now, the claim that the disciples lie for selfish motives and to go down in history as heroes, that still could be there, even though she's self-contradicting. Even though her article was self-contradicting. Even if the authors wrote fiction, I'm on the top of page 7, the fact remains, the disciples and others did maintain their belief. Is it not plausible to conclude that the martyrs were telling the truth? So I'm just basically saying that she still is not taking away the likelihood of the fact that someone will not die for a lie. And we have a quote here from The Case for Christ. People will die for their religious beliefs if they sincerely believe they're true, but people won't die for their religious beliefs if they know their beliefs are false. And so she's basically making the claim that it's more probable than not that the disciples were lying and they went to their death for it. But most probably all reasonable people would say that no one will die for a lie. No one's going to be tortured for it. They all know that it's useless to continue to be tortured and put to death for something they know is not true. So she's basically using academic scholarship and Ivy Tower thinking to say that, they probably did die for a lie because they wanted fame and power. So it just goes against common sense. Sometimes this is what happens in academia. The scholars who are brilliant, they do dumb stuff. They say things that just goes against common sense. Philosophers do this all the time. And what I'm saying here in item 7 and 8 is basically that there were Christians everywhere, and they were in all different walks of life. They were poor, they were rich, they were smart, they were not smart. And that's what Pliny the Younger is saying there. And he's saying that the Christians were blamed for whatever happened in Rome. This is what John Fox in Fox's Book of Martyrs says. And basically that Christians were beaten. I'm in the middle of 8 there. They were beaten, imprisoned, tortured, hung, eaten alive, burned to death, beheaded, crucified, stoned, disemboweled, whipped, torn apart, strangled, tossed onto the horns of bulls, had plates of hot iron pressed on them, and their dead bodies were thrown into mass graves to rot. And so Christians were persecuted in crazy, terrible ways for the belief that Jesus rose from the grave. And it doesn't make sense that what she is claiming, that all these Christians died for this lie, when if you take a cross-section through society, they're in all different parts of society, the rich, the poor, the smart, whatever. And it doesn't make sense that they would all agree to this strange conspiracy and they would all go through this torture for this lie because they all wanted fame and power. It doesn't make sense. So John Fox, he wrote Fox's Book of Martyrs, vehemently declares that nevertheless, the church continued to grow deeply rooted in the doctrine of the apostles and watered in the blood of the saints. So it is absurd to claim that people from all different walks of life and social classes would consent to this torture and martyrdom for fame and power. It's just a bad charge, but this is what scholars are claiming. This is what is written in the scholarly journals and in the history journals that are presented at society meetings for the professional philosophers and historians. Yes. That's a good point. We find that elsewhere they're embarrassing themselves by saying the women found the tomb, by not taking Jesus' body off the cross, things like this. But later on, they want power, fame, and popularity, and position in an institution. It doesn't make sense. So another charge is kind of a political charge, like a political revolutionary charge. It says they, meaning the disciples, didn't die because what they saw was real, a real Jesus, but because they wanted to rebel against the Roman rule, because they were Jews being oppressed by Rome, they wanted to overcome the oppressors. So meaning they wanted to do like what Gandhi did and what Martin Luther King did. They wanted to start a revolution. They wanted to rebel against the authorities that were occupying their country, that were oppressing them, taking away their freedoms, and making them pay taxes to Caesar. And they said, well, we'll let you torture us so you can feel bad. We'll let you kill us so you look terrible. And in the end, we're going to win now. It may take 300 years of this, but we're going to revolutionize this whole region, and Rome will go down. And so this historian, same person, Lucy Grigg, says that that's what actually happened. See, it's true. The Christians won. Constantine, the emperor, became a Christian in 325 AD, or around that time. And then revolutionized the Roman Empire to the Byzantine Empire, the Christian Empire, and moved the capital to Constantinople. This is what she claims. But it turns out that the same responses that we just went through apply to this charge as well. No need to repeat them here, but the point is that they lied for a cause that was not preaching, you know, the good news of Christ, Jesus, so that people could repent and be baptized. They died for a cause instead of of fame and popularity and position in the institution. This cause is political revolution and change through passive disobedience and or passive resistance and non-obedience. And so the other thing that I'm saying here in item 3 is, additionally, this would go against the very teaching of Jesus and his kingdom of truth, peace, and sacrifice. Jesus clearly exemplified this teaching at the hands of the Roman soldiers, not trying to spark a revolution politically, and he spoke clearly about the kingdoms of this world when he taught that we are to pay taxes to Caesar and give to God what is God's. Jesus was always trying to, they were always trying to put Jesus in a box. They're always trying to see how they can understand him and categorize him, and he never fit their categories. They thought he was going to be a political revolutionary like Gandhi or Martin Luther King and change society in certain ways like that. But Jesus rejected those things And he says, no, it's about the heart. It's about my kingdom. It's an everlasting kingdom, and it stretches beyond the borders of this region, and Rome, and all these areas. So it doesn't make sense, this charge. It goes against the very teaching of Jesus and his actual death. When Pilate says, are you the king of the Jews? He didn't even answer. And so Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. And I'm not sure the exact term off the top of my head, but he basically is rejecting that notion of being a political revolutionary, and he went to the death for that. So it doesn't make sense that the disciples would also try to start this revolution when their follower, when their mentor did not. Okay, charge number six. Let's see here. Let's do this one quickly and then take a break. Okay, charge number six. The martyrdom of the early church doesn't contribute evidential fact to the resurrection, just as the martyrdom of other religious radicals throughout history doesn't reveal any truth about their cause. Radical Muslims today frequently perform suicide bombings in the Middle East to defend the cause of Allah against the infidels with hopes of attaining a prosperous afterlife filled with riches and women. Moreover, followers of Jim Jones and David Koresh, cult leaders, if you don't know, went to their deaths believing a certain bad theology. Overall, one must conclude that every fanatical zealot's cause, theology, or historical claim is not to be believed or accepted just because the zealot dies for it. So we make the point as Christians that, see, the disciples died believing that Jesus rose from the grave. And they make a point, the criticism is, you can't use that because everybody dies for their cause. Are we supposed to go believing the Muslims or the cult followers of David Koresh? You can't just start believing what someone says is true because they go on and die for it. Well, that's a good criticism. What would you say to that? Don't look down at your notes. What would you say to that? We are using this as some of our evidence. We're talking about it already tonight, and we're going to talk about it next week. It's a huge piece of evidence that we have for the truth of the resurrection. So how do you respond to this charge that everybody or all these religious fanatics die for their beliefs? Doesn't prove their beliefs are true. Doesn't disprove it either. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah. Other thoughts? Say it again. What about them? Very good. Ding, ding, ding. The contribution to the evidence of the resurrection is valid due to the unique situation of the disciples and other eyewitnesses. When Joseph Smith found the tablets in the forest that the angel gave to him, were there other eyewitnesses there? No, he was alone in a forest. When Allah received the tablets or the Quran, the information for the Quran from the angel Gabriel in the cave in AD 600-ish, were there eyewitnesses there? No. What is different, well, besides Joseph Smith and Muhammad, no other eyewitnesses, right? What is different about the Gospels from Joseph Smith's story and Muhammad's story? The disciples were eyewitnesses to a supernatural event. They were eyewitnesses. We don't have eyewitnesses in any other religious source, founding of that religion.
And also the time differential between when Christ died and when the eyewitnesses were, let's say, interviewed, if that's the right word,
yeah,
was so relatively small.
I mean, yeah.
5, 10, 15, 20 years is not that long. 40 years is not that long.
Right.
That's a good difference. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And we make this claim elsewhere, is that the time period between the actual event and them writing is very small. It's 20, 30 years is not much. So this is extremely important because you don't have these eyewitnesses in other places when religions are founded. Item 4. Now, they may say, well, the early church, the disciples of the disciples weren't there to see the risen Jesus. What about them? Okay, well, that's true. It's similar to the Joseph Smith. It's similar to the Muhammad thing. They have to believe on the testimony of Joseph Smith or Muhammad or the disciples, just like we have to believe the testimony of the disciples. That's what Christianity is founded on. It's founded on eyewitness testimony. That makes it different than other religions. And we believe their testimony because we can cross-examine it. We could look at other things like circumstantial evidence, external evidence to the Bible, and we could say their testimony is valid and true, and what we say they are reporting makes sense. And so we have good reason to believe the eyewitness testimony of the disciples. Okay, and so that's what I'm saying in 4, basically. And Dr. J.P. Moreland in item 5 forcefully declares that the disciples were able to see with their own eyes, touch with their own hands. They were in a unique position not just to believe Jesus rose from the dead, but to know for sure. They had nothing to gain and everything to lose. So when the disciples saw the risen Jesus, they didn't go away, you know, the next day thinking, I believe I saw him. No, they knew they saw him. It was undeniable. They could not deny it. So when they were being tortured, they could not say, yeah, you're right, it was all a lie. They couldn't say that when they were being tortured. They couldn't say that when they were being executed and persecuted, because they knew it to be true. It was undeniable. They could not reject the person they saw. When Jesus says, reach out and touch the holes in my hand, and Thomas says, my Lord and my God, and Jesus says, you know, blessed are you who see and have faith, but more blessed are those, I'm paraphrasing, that have not seen. Meaning, it's more intriguing for us to believe the disciples' report and not have seen the holes in Jesus' hands and reached out and touched him like he did. Because we are using our minds to figure this out ourselves later on, but we are also trusting God. That faith, that not blind faith, but seeing faith, is more of an active trust. It's an obedience. And we're basically understanding God from all different angles, all different perspectives, and we're arriving at the truth of the conclusion that he rose from the grave. Let's see. So they knew for a fact. Now, go back up into item 4 there, the third line up from the bottom. It says, the belief in the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth is justified by the truth of, quote, I saw the bodily resurrected Jesus. Okay, so when they saw that with their own eyes, it was an empirical act of seeing. They were able to look at something and test it. Like, there's Jesus, he's not a ghost. I can reach out and touch him. He's eating fish. The fish is not dropping on the ground because he's a ghost. It's in his stomach. I can't see it. He's a real human. They had empirical evidence for it. So when you have philosophers today, scientism, naturalism, saying, I need verifiable empirical evidence. I need to taste it, touch it, see it, smell it, hear it, for it to be real, for it to be something I can say I have knowledge of. Well, the disciples had empirical evidence. Their epistemological needs were met, okay? Meaning that epistemology, how to know something, that those needs, that criteria that Thomas had an extra special epistemological criteria that hadn't been met yet, because he wasn't there when Jesus first entered the room to appear to them. He wasn't there that day. That was the Resurrection Sunday, by the way. A week later, Jesus does appear and Thomas is there, and his extra special criteria was met. So if you're the skeptic and you said, I need hard evidence, I need to touch it, taste it, see it, smell it, you have it. Thomas had it. He was that skeptic. If you ever encountered that skeptic on the street, that he's that skeptical, you can say, you know what, there is a skeptic just like you. He did not believe, even when the guys he spent the last 3 years with were telling him that they saw the resurrected Jesus. Even when the ladies that saw the empty tomb and saw him at the garden. And he didn't believe them. You're not believing me right now. But I'm telling you, Jesus later appeared to him, and a week later, he was amazed by it. He says, "My Lord and my God," to Jesus when he saw him. Because Jesus reached out his hand, didn't he? He says, "I want to meet your epistemological criteria. I want you to be fully satisfied that I'm real, I'm not a ghost, my body has been resurrected, and it's fully here for you to touch. It's important that you understand that it was a body." We're going to talk about that after the break, and not just a spirit, not just a ghost. So I want to encourage you, if you run into a skeptic, or you yourself are skeptical because you don't have hard evidence, consider Thomas being your representative in that time, and consider his needs being met and him being able to say, "My Lord and my God." Okay, so as we have seen, these two items actually don't belong there, so just ignore them. They belong up in charge number 4, but we don't need to chat about it right now. So in conclusion, the big bold item there, A, on page 10, we have seen that the charges against the evidence for Jesus' resurrection are inaccurate. They're faulty. They're untruthful. Okay, so then we can say Jesus resurrected as Christians. We can make that claim. Sorry, a scholar. He got antsy. He wanted to join the conversation, Ben. So we can make that claim, and then when the charges are brought against us, when we make that claim, we've rebutted them, and we can reject those charges. So our claim still stands, Jesus resurrected. Do you see how that works? Okay. Questions? Yes, sir. No, there are not any other writings outside of Scripture by the 500. But what was the first question?
A lot of I've seen atheists where they say, well, regarding the witnesses, they say, well, you only got three or four people.
Yeah. Well, no, we have more than that, because he appeared to the 12, well, the 11, because Judas was gone. So we have 11. We have Marys, the Marys that were at the tomb. So we have a bunch there. Yeah, okay, the followers.
Yeah.
And the 500. Yeah, so that's a lot.
I guess their point was saying, I can say, I made up a story, there's 500 people there.
Right, okay, that's a good point. You know what? That's a good point. We're going to get back to that, actually, after the break. How do you trust these people that say there's 500 others, and how do we know they're not making up the 500, and all the other people that we have are his disciples, or the Marys, or whatever? Yeah, okay. Well, my first response is, and we'll talk about this later, but where's the body? Produce the body. If you have it, show it. That's the first thing. Okay, they can't do that, and the Pharisees knew that. And we're going to see this here just in a second, actually. So your question is just 5 minutes too early. So we'll talk about that. Anybody else? Question? Yes, sir? Yeah, I would say when you put all these, remember we went through the 10 pieces of evidence he provided for us that shows that he did fulfill the attributes of the Messiah, and then other people claim that he was God, or he fulfilled the attributes of God, and then other people claim that he was God. and he agreed with that claim, or he did not say, no, you're not right, I'm not God. So those two things, those 10 things and then that extra thing, that gives us a firm confidence that he was God.
So essentially that we're saying, okay, Jesus is God, he died for our sins, and you have to believe, since he's God, you have to believe what he said he will die for your sins.
Yeah.
And then the bottom line is, having accepted that, the question is, okay, so what now, what do we do? That's the Great Commission, which comes later.
Yeah, so you're right. You're presenting like a full gospel message here. So you're saying Jesus was God. Here's these 10 lines of evidence. People said he was God. And then he resurrected, proving that what he said. You know. And then you say, now, what do you do with that, Mr. Non-Christian? And let them come face to face with Jesus and deny him after they see Jesus face to face. We're going to try to bring down all the walls that prevent barriers to unbelief so that they can see Jesus face to face. That's the goal. Okay, let's take a quick break, 5 minutes or so, okay? All right, thanks.